yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, the 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to do our normal review of the main events of the past week. But I really do want to jump in both feet here on this whole Mueller affair. All right, the Mueller report, of which I've been reading through it here, 448 pages. Of legalese. Nonetheless, there are some very eye-opening sections of that particular report that if you haven't read it, you ought to know about it, or at least I'll talk about it a little bit here. What's the difference between what's going on today with Mueller and the Mueller report and Congress and talk about impeachment and the actual impeachment of Richard Nixon? And why does it look like the Democrats are going to fail? Once again, in recent years, getting outmaneuvered and outflanked by the Republicans and the radical right time and time again. Democratic leadership is not what it was in the 1970s. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Mueller report. I want to talk about in comparisons with the Watergate, Russiagate versus Watergate. And what are the differences today? As we see the Trump administration turn over foreign policy to the neocons, Bolton, John Bolton and Mueller running the immigration policy, and Abrams and Navarro and Lighthizer running trade, and the disasters that that's creating globally for the U.S. Okay, so let's hold off on that. We'll come back to that. By the way, my latest piece appeared in Counterpunch yesterday. I suggest you take a look at it or go to my blog, which is just checkrasmus.com, entitled U.S.-China Trade War, Hiatus, or Busted Deal. Well, I think we've crossed the kind of a Rubicon here. It's been a simmering trade war up to now, but for reasons I'll talk about, it's looks like it's becoming a real thing. Okay, so let's talk about some of the events of the past week. Well, let's start with the China-U.S. trade war follow-up. Of course, last week's show we talked about that in depth. Up through last Thursday, and then, of course, the whole China deal, China trade deal, blew up on Friday, and the Chinese team went back home, and the stock market took a deep dive, and Trump tried to backpedal. At the same time, he was upping threats, trying to put a spin on it that, oh, this is just a squabble, oh, we'll get together again, and so on and so forth. But, you know, it's not just a squabble. That's the spin. Now it's pretty serious, right? At a time that the U.S. economy is showing increasing signs of weakness, and we'll talk about that too. Okay, so what's happened with the China trade follow-up here, China-U.S. trade war follow-up, right? Well, you know, Trump has threatened, while he's saying it's one side of his mouth, he's saying, oh, it's not a bad thing. I got a nice letter from Xi, blah, blah. That's President Xi of China. And at the same time, he tells his administration to start preparing tariffs on another $325 billion. You know, there's tariffs already on $250 billion. And you know, he's a Mr. Tariff Man. He thinks that solves everything because it's a threat. That's the, you know, he negotiates by threats all the time. And the $250 billion brought in, you know, some revenue from the tariffs for the U.S. It resulted in what's called net exports gaining. What's net exports? Well, I talk about it in that article. But basically, it's the difference between exports and imports. And if you reduce your imports, you increase your net exports. And any increase in net exports shows up as an increase in GDP. In other words, lower your economic activity by buying less from abroad, and it looks like your GDP has been boosted. Well, there's no real increase in U.S. production and output, but it looks that way. That's one of the strange elements of how we calculate GDP. You know, there's some absurd things in GDP, like counting the amount of rent that homeowners with mortgages somehow pay themselves. Well, nobody pays themselves for rent in the homes that they own. Ah, but that's part of GDP calculation, you see. Makes it look bigger than it actually is. There's all kind of strange elements in the GDP. And I've talked about them from time to time. You know, a big revision in 2013 added $500 billion to GDP by counting logos and trademarks and putting a dollar value on something very arbitrarily. But somehow that boosted it, and counting spending on R&D as GDP. Countries manipulate GDP when things look bad in order to make it look better on paper, and they can spin it. Okay, so we've talked about that before. But basically, net exports and GDP get a boost whenever you have tariffs that raise revenue. And, you know, maybe Trump is thinking, I raised revenue and made it look like GDP was better with $250 billion tariffs on the Chinese. Well, let's throw another $325 billion on them. And I'll boost GDP here in the coming quarters, make it look good. All right. So he does that. He boosts tariffs on the $200 billion that already existed from 10% to 25%. In other words, he raised them 15%. And now he's talking about another 25% on another $325 billion. Okay, so China responded by raising tariffs by 15% from 10 to 25, roughly on average, on $60 billion. I think they have a total of $100 billion on U.S. Imports to China, and we have $250 billion on them. They import far less than we do from them, and that gives them a trade deficit for them, you know, close to $500 billion a year. And when you got a trade deficit like that, that means, you know, you've got $500 billion of U.S. dollars net flowing into China. And, that helps boost China's holdings of U.S. treasuries, because China then recycles that money, those dollars, and buys U.S. treasuries. And because it buys U.S. treasuries, in other words, it makes up for the budget deficit in the U.S., which is caused by big tax cuts in the U.S. for big corporations and investors, and war spending, two big causes of deficits, and therefore the debt. You know, and deficits are running $1 trillion a year in the U.S. now. But the Chinese and others who have these big surpluses from the trade deficit with the U.S., they just recycle them. Oh, but what happens, and buy treasuries, but what happens when they stop recycling or slow the recycling? Well, the U.S. budget deficit theoretically can get larger, which means the Federal Reserve has to sell more treasury bonds. How do they do that? They raise interest rates. That slows the economy. Oh, big contradiction there, you see. Well, if the Chinese go there, what does that mean? Okay, that's a big weapon they got. Another weapon the Chinese have is to allow their currency to devalue, the yuan, against the dollar. Well, you know, if you raise tariffs by 5% and you and the Chinese allow their currency to devalue by 5%, you got a net result. You've neutralized the U.S. tariff moves. But Trump's too dumb to understand that, I guess. Okay, so the U.S. has increased tariffs on $200 billion by 15%. Well, guess what? In 1 week, the Chinese yuan has depreciated by 3% already, from 6.7-something to the dollar to almost 7 to the dollar. And why, perhaps, is it doing this? Well, because China is also now buying less treasuries. Last month, reduced its purchase of U.S. treasuries by $20 billion. And it's been buying fewer and fewer ever since September. And now it reduces. And none, you know, they've crossed the Rubicon here. China's response, of course, was also to raise tariffs on $60 billion by 15%. But watch its currency depreciation and watch its purchase of fewer U.S. treasuries. And then it could take other moves in China as well, you know, raise nationalist fervor, get people to buy less from U.S. corporations there, give special support to companies challenging U.S. companies in China, you know, like give support to the company there, I forget what it was called, Starbucks, coffee, right? Starbucks has a big presence in China. Well, China is pushing its challenger to Starbucks. You know, that's just one of hundreds or thousands of examples it could undertake. Okay, so China currency is slowly depreciating. China purchases of treasuries look like they may be shifting. Right, China has raised tariffs. Right. And the U.S. stock market, as I predicted at the beginning of last week, the Dow went down 5%. Okay, it's recovered ever since, at least part, right? But if you look behind the scenes, investors are now clearly getting out of stocks and moving into bonds in the U.S. They see something coming now. Business, I think, really believes this trade war has crossed the kind of Rubicon here. And who knows what's going to happen next. The uncertainty has certainly risen. Trump, of course, has used the opportunity here of this situation to put even more pressure on the U.S. Federal Reserve to say lower rates. China has stimulated its economy by increasing the money supply and lowering rates and reserves for its businesses. Come on, Powell, Chairman Powell, reduce rates again in the U.S., and boost that stock market back up. We're going to see more pressure on the Fed to do that. That's already been occurring for months now, since last December, as we've talked about in previous shows. Okay, but Trump is blamed, and the Trump administration blamed the Chinese. You know, the line, the spin is that, oh, the Chinese in the week before they came over here for the last meeting last week, what did they do? They changed the terms of the agreement unilaterally. Well, as I pointed out in my article on my blog, jackrasmus.com, about the trade war hiatus or busted deal, right? No. The U.S., started changing the terms of agreement before the Chinese ever came to the U.S. In the 2 weeks preceding, you know, they threatened to raise tariffs on the rest of the, you know, trade with China, $325 billion. They signaled China and said, hey, we're going to keep tariffs on some of this stuff anyway, you know. After both sides were talking about reducing and eliminating tariffs. You know, well, we're going to keep some tariffs. And another onerous proposal was that, look, China, you have to stop this tech transfer of U.S. companies in China. And, by the way, Your tech development, particularly in the next generation key technologies, 5G, cyber security, and AI, are you going to share it with us anyway? And by the way, we're going to keep going after Huawei and China Mobile and all these other companies to prevent them from doing business in the United States. And we're going to push our allies to dump Huawei as well, even if it means more cost for them. You know, Pompeo goes over to Britain and he talks to the parliament and he tells them, you got to get out of 4G with Huawei and buy our 5G wireless network. Well, that means that the Brits have to strip out their development of 4G that they did with Huawei before and pay an extra big cost to the U.S. Providers, AT&T and others. You see, a lot of this is going after AT&T's competitors for them. And you got to go with our 5G. At the same time, the Trump administration is putting pressure on the Germans, saying, we're going to slap you with sanctions, you know, if you don't stop buying Russian gas and start buying our gas, because we got a surplus of natural gas. Even though our gas is more expensive, Germans, you got to scuttle your pipeline with Russia, and you got to go and, you know, buy our gas. And if not, we're going to hit you with sanctions. You know, Trump's going all around the world, you know, threatening tariffs and sanctions, because sanctions are a way of saying also stop buying other folks' stuff or stop selling to other countries or buying from other countries and buy from us. You know, this is all about the government, the state, forcing other countries to do business with U.S. businesses instead. And sanctions, we're going to hit you with sanctions if you don't like it, right? And tariffs, behind the tariffs are the sanctions. You see, they go hand in hand. And both tariffs and sanctions are really designed at another level to depress the country's currency against the dollar, because the dollar is the global currency, right? 85% of all trade in the U.S. is done, globally, is done in dollars. Right? 60% of all reserves of currency in the world are dollars. And commodities, oil and other commodities, 100% virtually in dollar trade. So if your currency depreciates against the dollar, you got to pay more for all this stuff. And sanctions and tariffs are designed to depress the currency of other countries. This is financial imperialism, you see. This is dollar imperialism. Trade tariffs, sanctions, currency exchange rate depression. This is all financial imperialism. And the U.S. is resorting to it aggressively like never before. Well, that's a reflection of the growing long-run weakness of the U.S. Empire here. Just the beginning. No one says this is about the collapse or the dollar's about to collapse. No, it's quite a ways from that. But anyway, this is part of the strategy. Well, you know, Trump says it's the Chinese that started reneging and backtracking. Well, no, the record shows clearly that it's the U.S., which is the influence of the hardliners on the U.S. negotiating team, the neocons. You know, the Lighthizers and Navarros and Boltons, they don't want to deal with China unless China totally capitulates, not negotiates, capitulates on the tech question, on the technology development question. China has already agreed to the demand of the U.S. to open up and allow majority ownership of U.S. companies and their joint ventures in China. They've already agreed to that, 51% and more. They've already agreed over the next 6 years to buy $1.2 trillion more of U.S. farm goods and manufactured goods and natural gas. They've already agreed to those major, major concessions. What's holding it up are the U.S. neocons who want a capitulation on tech. And even if there is an agreement, even if they back off of that extreme demand, even if that happens, the U.S. is going to continue to go after Chinese tech companies and corral its allies behind it in the same. They're going to continue to do that. This trade war over tech is really the opening shot in a new Cold War with China. that may eventually lead in the next decade to a hot war. Who knows? The U.S. sees a great threat in China to its global hegemony, and it's moving to maneuver to stop it. And the U.S. has done this before. In my new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, I talk about global restructuring by the U.S. elites. There was a major global restructuring just before and during World War I as the U.S. Prepared to take its place on a competitive equal basis with the British Empire. Right? And you could see the two currencies in the early 20s sort of vying as the gold standard collapsed with each other. And, of course, that global hegemony was solidified after World War II with the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944. The U.S., of course, not only defeated the Germans and the Japanese, they defeated the British Empire and became the hegemon globally, and the British became a weak second sister. I mean, Britain was so financially devastated by the Second World War, after the war ended, they came to the U.S. and they said, please give us a grant. We need $6 billion to put our empire back on its feet. And the U.S. said, well, I think they actually asked for like 10 or 20 billion. And the U.S. says, no, we're not going to give you anything, Britain. We will loan you $6 billion, but in exchange, you got to turn over part of your global empire, particularly in the Middle East and its oil, to us. And that's exactly what the Brits did. Beginning of the end for the Brits. And now you see this comical act called Brexit, you know, the last hurrah of the British Empire. Anyway, the point I was leading up to is that Trump and the administration is blaming the Chinese when it's actually them that are scuttling the trade deal. But the New York Times is buying the Trump wine. If you read their headline today, right? Pretty much the New York Times, May 17th, today, supports the Trump view that, oh, the Chinese started it. They started the backtracking. Yeah, well, that's not the facts. But that's the line, you see. Both wings of the U.S. global elite, the capitalist elite, they close ranks. And they're pretty much closed ranks on this China thing, right? You know, you don't hear the Democrats, Pelosi and Schumer, criticizing Trump on this China negotiations, do you? No. They may be, challenging Trump's other gross, aggressive missteps, you know, like in Yemen, or this attempt to provoke a war here, Bolton's war with Iran. Yeah, they may say something about that, you know, very tepid, timid responses. But as far as the China trade war, no, they're all aligned on that, right? So President Xi has said, I don't think we're going to have a meeting in June. I have no plans for it. Trump, of course, was pressing the message that, oh, we'll get together G20 in June and resolve this. Xi says, no, I'm not so sure, right? U.S. businesses are now really pushing. They're pushing Trump here to do something about this, right? So what's Trump going to do? He's going to give more subsidies to the farmers. That's what he's going to do. He's already given $12 billion, which only partly covers their losses. But you're going to see more of it. Where's it going to come from? Where's it going to come from? Well, Trump has already upset the constitutional relationship with the legislature, with Congress, by saying, I'm just going to divert money from things you passed and said money should be spent to. I'm going to divert it to what I want it to. Well, that's a violation of the Constitution and constitutional norms. All this declaring of national emergencies every time he wants to do something is another example of violating of constitutional norms. You know, that gives him sole authority to dictatorially do what he wants and bypass Congress on global trade and foreign policy. National emergency, right? Therefore, the executive can do what it wants, and the hell with Congress. The hell with checks and balances. We got a constitutional crisis that is beginning to emerge in this country. Okay. So back to the farmers. He's going to divert money somewhere else. And I'll bet you he's going to divert it from housing for the poor. Already he's indicating he's going to cut the money allocated for housing for the poor, allocated by Congress, and he's going to move it somewhere else, just as he's moving defense funds to build his wall. You know, this is a kind of a unilateral rule going on here. You know, this is kind of executive branch dictatorship that's emerging. You know, of course, he's at the top of the executive branch, so it's kind of a surrogate Trump move, shift towards ruling unilaterally and bypassing and ignoring Congress. Right? Oh, and then we have, you know, another violation here above the law, right? He says, I can pardon myself. And he's also telling his staff and, you know, executive branch, no, even if you're subpoenaed, don't go talk to Congress. He's refusing to release the redacted report of the Mueller report. You know, another example, above the law. He thinks he's above the law. Well, that's the definition of tyrant, above the law, tyranny, and a drift towards policy dictatorship at the same time. Okay, so back to Trump intensifying, going after Huawei, now China Mobile, China responding because the CFO of Huawei got arrested in Canada at the U.S. behest, and the U.S. wants that person, Wang something, I think, Zhu or something, extradited to the U.S. Well, the Chinese responded and done the same with some Canadians. All right. This thing is getting hotter. And the next month or so may be very interesting. I had previously thought that, you know, the U.S. elite would bring Trump to heel. But, you know, the original U.S. Elites that were embedded in his initial administration have been driven out or threw their hands up, gave up, and left. I mean, there's a whole line of them, right? Remember the three generals, McMaster, Kelly, and I forgot the third one, right? They've been all driven out. Yeah. And who's come in the vacuum? The neocons, the crazies, the guys who gave us Iraq, the Boltons. Bolton's running foreign policy in this country. You notice that? Who's running immigration policy? Miller, right? Another neocon. Who's running trade policy? Lighthizer Navarro. The neocons are running the show because this guy is a joke. Trump is a joke. He sits up there in the White House, second floor, tweets, you know, 40, 50 tweets in an hour sometimes. Yeah. They're taking advantage of him because he's so dumb. You know? Oh, but he's a street fighter. He's clever. He's clever at advancing his own opportunities and protecting his own. And he's surrounding himself now with sycophants. Ah, but he's got a real base, too, at the same time. Makes it hard to touch him because he's taken over the Republican Party. This is not the Republican Party of previous decades, right? These are sycophants and lightweights who are terrorized that Trump will turn loose his right-wing media supporters, you know, the Hannitys and I don't know all the name of all those clowns, right? And they won't get their nomination to run and continue their careers as politicians without the support of Trump and his base, 40%. 40% of the American population support him no matter what. I mean, he could strangle his grandmother on the White House lawn and they'd still vote for him. This is a significant change in what's going on in America and the quality of the leadership and the electorate, I would even say. Okay, so stock market will continue to drift lower. But why? Why is the stock market even, I mean, it ought to be plunging. Why is it recovering somewhat, although the drift long run is down? Well, pretty easy to explain, folks, you know. Massive buybacks of stocks. Massive. How massive? This year, the stock buybacks of U.S. corporations will be running at nearly $1 trillion. Nearly a trillion. $900 billion to a trillion. This, you know, first quarter was well over $250 billion in stock buybacks. So whenever the stock market takes a dive because of events and weakness of the economy, the institutional buyers now, the hedge funds and equity firms and those guys who are responsible for 85% of the stock purchases, right? They take their massive store of dollars that they've accumulated on the sidelines and they push them in to the stock market, see it as a buying opportunity, drives the stock back up. Tech companies, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies, health insurance companies, right? Banks, oil and energy companies, buybacks galore. This is what's keeping the stock market up or recovering every time there's a correction when there should have been a major correction a long time ago. Okay, so we're going to see more of this with the stock market going on. What about the U.S. economy itself? You know, I wrote an article about behind the facts of the first quarter GDP and said if you, not long ago, I had a show on that, I think about a month ago, but if you look at first quarter GDP, it was all inventory buildup by business and net exports because of the trade war. And in fact, the inventory buildup, you could argue, is related to the trade war as businesses began stocking up because uncertainty about tariffs and how far this will go. They're preparing to buy things whether, you know, while they can. That are cheaper. So that's why we got inventory buildup, and that's why we got net exports. It's trade war related, I think, largely. And if you looked at the real sources behind U.S. GDP, consumer spending, it was down to 1.2% in first quarter, pretty much flat. And the same thing, you know, with business, real business investment in equipment and structures. You know, it's slowing rapidly. Well, what did we see with regard to that trend? Well, numbers last month kind of confirm that it's accelerating. Retail sales were down a negative 0.2%, and core retail, in other words, without looking at you know, inflation, core and food, energy, food, flat, no gain in April. That's the month that they're supposed to be spending their tax refunds, which they're not getting, you see. That's why. Next week, we will see big box retail. What's going to happen with the Targets and the JCPenney's and so forth? Well, important to watch. Industrial production, which is manufacturing and utilities, was also down last month by a negative 0.5% for the month. Manufacturing, same thing, negative 0.5. Autos are in free fall. Auto sales, negative 2.6% in 1 month. Good time to think about buying an auto, a new car here come, you know, the promotion times right before July 4th or Labor Day. Morgan Stanley, research bank, forecast second quarter GDP is only going to be 1.2%. Right? Big drop from the 3.2% of the first quarter, which, as I've said, was due largely because of trade issues and inventories, which are gone, by the way, in the second quarter, which means probably the underlying growth GDP in first quarter was about 1%, which the banks were forecasting, you see, for the first quarter. Now they're forecasting the same 1.2%. All right. Okay. Here's another important survey, indication of where the economy isn't going. Survey, 1,500 chief financial officers, CFOs. Half of all the U.S. CFOs say a recession is likely at the end of 2019. Well, I've been saying fourth quarter 2019 could be the target date for the beginning of the recession in the U.S. for over a year. I've been targeting fourth quarter. Well, now we got half of the CFOs are saying that's likely too. You don't believe me? Read the Wall Street Journal today, May 17th, page 8. Read the survey. Okay. And all this talk about jobs, 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 and we've been addressing that issue here and debating that issue in recent weeks and on my blog too. How accurate are U.S. job numbers? Go read it, jackrasmus.com. Right? Well, there's some anecdotal evidence here continuing to appear. For example, Amazon. Remember Amazon? Oh, they're going to create all those jobs, 30,000, 40,000 jobs in Virginia and Long Island, et cetera, right? And I wrote how Amazon was a job killer, not a job creator. Well, you know, what did Amazon recently say this past week? It said, well, you know, we're going to give some incentives for our workers in the warehouse, because now we're going to automate the warehouses, right? Some incentives to become independent contractors, right? Leave the company so we don't have to pay you benefits or holiday pay or vacation and wages and so forth, and become independent contractors. We'll hire you back. You know, you can help deliver as an independent contract the last leg deliveries to houses and apartments and so forth, right? Become independent and work for us, right? And of course, we won't pay you anything in terms of benefits, et cetera. We'll save all that money. We won't have to pay UPS and FedEx, right? We'll pay you less than we have to pay them, right? We're getting into the FedEx UPS business by having you become independent contractors. Right? And then we will cherry pick those who really deliver fast, we'll keep, and those of you who don't come up to our standards, we just won't renew your contract with us. Right? This is this whole trend towards driving people out of full-time permanent jobs, which we talked about, 400,000 last 2 months, decline, full-time jobs, and having them become contingent, part-time temp jobs. Well, you know, the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics data, doesn't show that much of an increase in part-time temp jobs. Well, I argued they're underestimating that. It's impossible that that's not happening because I think a lot of these part-time jobs, temp jobs, are showing up in the category of independent contractors, which has been growing leaps and bounds, you know, by millions in recent years. I think we got over 10 million now independent contractors. Yeah. Well, most of those folks are working part-time, temp, on contract, you know, with the big companies. And if the companies don't like it, they just don't renew your contract or don't give you as much work. You know, you're really part-time and employed, and you have a temporary relationship that could be cut any time with these major companies. And talk about employees. The courts, NLRB, Labor Relations Board, just ruled that Uber employees aren't employees. They are independent contractors, which means they can't form a union, you see, to press, and they can't go on strike to press their demand for better wages. This is a loophole in the labor laws, right? You're an independent contractor. You're not an employee. Therefore, they don't have to pay you benefits. Well, the Uberization of the economy is driving the numbers out of the traditional categories of full-time and even part-time, official part-time, and it's driving them. They're there, right? But they're not full-time anymore, and they're not even part-time showing up in U3 or U6 unemployment rates. Okay, so Uberization of the labor markets in the U.S. and the Amazon effect, as I call it, are all impacting jobs negatively. Okay, so, well, that was kind of a long preview of the economy here, not leaving all that much time to talk about the Moore report, but let's do that now, right? There was a show on TV, I think it was CBS, Frontline, it's called, right, on the Mueller report. Very disappointing, right? Showed a lot of events up until recent months, right? And the really interesting developments since the report was issued were not covered more than a few seconds. About 30 seconds on what Attorney General Barr is doing, or not doing, refusing to do, right? But there was some interesting coverage, you know, of past months, past years, right? I found it interesting, you know, Trump and Barr and Fox News and the media are alleging no collusion, no collusion, no obstruction. Right? No collusion, no obstruction. Well, the Mueller report is kind of iffy on collusion. But the Frontline show was interesting because it showed Trump having private conversations with the Russians, which are very suspect. You know, we know about the Helsinki meeting, right, with Putin. Remember that, where they both get on stage and he says, Trump says, oh, I believe Putin. You know, he didn't do anything. You know, he's a man of his word, whatever. Well, you know, what's interesting is that there were no U.S. interpreters or no U.S., I believe, and no U.S. officials accompanied him in that meeting. It was kind of a private meeting, especially before the press report and the cameras. No one knows what they really discussed. I mean, that's kind of funny that a president would do that, I find, you know. Usually you have that kind of a discussion where there's no witnesses when you got something to hide. Even more interesting was shown in this TV report show, Frontline, how I think it was after he fired Comey, the FBI guy or something, he had the Russian ambassadors come into the White House. And, you know, I forget the name of the Russian ambassador, but the finance minister there, Lavrov, and the Russian ambassador. And they're all buddy-buddy joking and laughing with each other, right? And again, no U.S. witnesses to that. How do we know these photos? Well, the Russians took the photos. And somehow Frontline got control, bought the photos or something, right? And they're all buddy-buddy, you know, like a class reunion going on, you know, slapping each other in the back, smiling, laughing, you know. And Trump reportedly, according to the story, tells them, well, this whole investigation is under control now. I fired Comey. These are weird smoking gun kind of meetings, okay? Okay, about collusion. And then the show is a lot about all his lieutenants, you know, from Cohen and Flynn and all the others, and Manafort, and all the examples of smoking gun collusion. Okay, so they didn't prove collusion, but read the Mueller report. There certainly is a mountain of evidence about obstruction, right? Especially read Volume 2. I mean, this is cheap. You can go buy it for $9, I think, online. You know, the report from the Washington Post here and all the secondary materials and everything. And read Volume 2, the introduction to Volume 2, which begins on page 266, and especially those parts from page 277 on, entitled Factual Results of the Obstruction Investigation. Factual. Right. And even with the redactions there, I mean, the incidents, the examples are overwhelming. I think this guy was engaging in all kinds of obstruction. And that's what they got Richard Nixon on, you see, was obstruction of justice, of the investigation. So, you know, I'm not going to go over the Mueller report. Page 277 of Washington Post. Go get it. Read it, you know, for yourself. Okay, so, you know, what we got is a Russiagate or a Trumpgate. I don't know what you would rather call it going on here. And the obstruction of justice is clearly, I'm not a legal scholar, but clearly grounds for impeachment investigations, right? The Democrats, of course, don't want impeachment. At least the leadership doesn't want. You know, the newcomers to the Democratic Party are demanding it. But Pelosi, Schumer don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. They say, oh, you know, look, it backfired for the Republicans when they went after Clinton on sex charges, which is kind of not in the same category here. Morality, sex charges compared to what's going on now. But they say, look, the Republicans, got caught in a backwash on this. No, they didn't. Yeah, the Republicans lost a few seats in the by-election in 98, which of course always happens to the dominant party. Right? But they came back in 2000 and thereafter sweeping elections. It didn't hurt them. It didn't hurt them. As far as elections, I mean, this is a fake cover by Pelosi and Schumer here. Oh, we don't want to do that because we may lose more votes. Look, you're not going to lose any of the 40% who would vote for Trump, even if he strangled his grandmother in the White House lawn, as I said, right? They'd vote for him anyway, right? So forget those folks. What about the 20% in the middle? Because the country is split 40-40, I think. You know, we haven't seen this kind of division at the grassroots in the country since the 1850s, leading up to the Civil War. Very similar in some ways to the 1850s, where the institutions were split, where they were not functioning accurately or effectively, rather. I'm talking about executive and legislative branches were totally at each other's throat and nothing could be done. And the courts finally flipped on one side or the other and exacerbated the whole situation, Supreme Court, Dred Scott decision and all that, right? It's in some ways, it's similar, right? The country is divided. By the way, that's a big difference between now and the Nixon impeachment. The country was not divided over this overwhelmingly. Well, one of the reasons for the division is back then we had a more respected and unified view media, CBS, NBC, ABC, so forth, right? The elites of the capitalist class, that's their institutions, their media institutions, they were dominant. And when the elites decided, well, Nixon had to go, there was no disagreement. People at the grassroots were getting the same story. Well, they're not now, you see. You got Fox News, you got all this cable news, cable radio news, and so forth, and internet sources that are supporting the radical right, that is supporting Trump. Yeah, that's different. Country's divided, the media is divided, and the right-wing media is feeding a lot of folks a lot of crap, right? Treating them like mushrooms, right? Feed them shit and keep them in the dark. That's middle America, that's the heartland, right? They're eating a lot of shit and they're in the dark because they're believing all of this media, right-wing media, from Fox on down. And there's a lot of ways down, by the way. What's also different is the Supreme Court is now in Trump's in the right-wing hand, and they know it. Yeah? And that emboldens them. That emboldens them. Trump is pretty much sticking his thumb in the eye of Congress, or at least the House, right? He's got his puppy there, McConnell, doing his bidding, and history will show the damage this guy McConnell has done to the country by just agreeing to whatever Trump wants him to. He's sticking his thumb in the eye And he said, okay, you know, go ahead. And I got the Supreme Court. I believe they'll support me. So that's what's different here. Supreme Court was much more independent back then than it is now, right? What's also different is Trump is a street fighter, you know? He's pretty dumb when it comes to economics and things like that. And he's, you know, pretty much defers to the neocons on foreign policy because no one else wants to, you know, be a part of his administration. But he's a street fighter. He doesn't give up. Unlike Nixon, you know, Nixon was whining and crying in the White House there, drinking and, you know, oh me, oh my, my presidency and so forth. You know, I mean, he was totally collapsed to the point at one point there that his administration, Kissinger and some of the others there, I forget the name of some of the others, were kind of running the show. He had totally collapsed. Well, Trump shows no sign of collapse. This guy's a street fighter, and he'll continue. He's not going to go down on his knees and start praying in the White House like Nixon did. So that's what's different between now and Watergate. What's also different is that the political parties are in decay, I think. The Republican Party has been captured by Trump, pretty much. You know, at the grassroots, they're terrified of being ganged up upon by the radical right and prevented from getting even the nomination. This has happened many times throughout the country in the Republican Party to run again. So they're thinking about their own opportunist, you know, careers, and they're going along with Trump, a lot of them who otherwise might stand up to him. And those who would stand up to him have looked at it from the inside and said, oh, this is hopeless. I'm talking about the Senator Corkers and what's that guy from Arizona? I can't remember, Flay or something. You know, they're leaving the ship in droves, you see, at the congressional House level as well, at the Senate level, at administration level. You know, three generals throwing up their hands and left. You know, the State Department and the defense and so forth. Guys like Republican traditionalist advisors, they've left. Cohn, you know, economic advisor, he's left. Was that guy who was from Exxon State Department? He's left, right? And you got this big vacuum, and no one with any quality ability wants to take any of those jobs. But the neocons love it. They're just jumping in droves. You know, some rats leave the ship, and other rats climb back in. So he's captured the Republican Party, pretty much. And the Republican Party, you know, ever since Newt Gingrich in 1994, had a strategy that we're going, and it's public, they said this, we're going to make the U.S. government ineffective, right? We're going to undermine the confidence in the institutions. That's our objective. That was Newt Gingrich's objective in 1994, Contract with America, right? And that's been the developing strategy ever since. That's McConnell's strategy, of course, ever since Obama got in office, right? Render it ineffective. Don't allow any appointments to judges or to labor boards or the Federal Reserve. Block them all. And once we win, then we'll fill them with our folks. McConnell, you know, is outmaneuvered the Democrats. And I blame Obama for a lot of this, you know, his sort of minimalist leadership, wanting to be bipartisan with Republicans for 8 years. You know, he stretches out his hand and the Republican dog bites it every time. And, you know, you still see this bipartisanship BS, you know, with Pelosi. Right? We want to be bipartisan and we're going to try to compromise. Well, of course, now they're maybe coming to realize there's no compromise, only 10 years late. And Joe Biden's the same thing. Joe Biden says, you know, he's in that ilk, and he said, oh, not all Republicans are bad. You know, it's only Trump. Yeah? Tell that to your buddy McConnell over there in the Senate and all those other lackeys, Trump lackeys in the House. And the Democrats are getting outmaneuvered time again, I think, right? They relied on Comey first, the FBI, and Comey flip-flopped, right? Comey goes after, in July of 2016, goes after Hillary Clinton, right? Because the Republicans were pushing him to do that. Oh, and then it went too far, so he flipped the other way. And we know the whole story of Comey here. Right. Then they rely on the Mueller report, and the Mueller report comes out, and it doesn't indict Trump, even though the obstruction of justice is overwhelming. So why not? Look, this is the crux. This is the important point about all of this investigation. I'm going to say it right now, right? It's the following. Ever since Clinton, the presidents have instructed their Justice Departments to issue a rule, a Justice Department rule that says special counsels cannot indict a sitting president. In other words, Mueller, if he goes by those rules and he's hired by the Justice Department, he shouldn't be hired by, he should be hired by Congress. But he's hired by the Justice Department. The fox is protecting the hen house here. Right? And the Justice Department says, these are the rules, Mueller, you cannot indict a sitting president. In other words, as long as a president is sitting, he is above the law, if you abide by those rules. In other words, he can be a tyrant as long as he's in office. He's above the law. And that's exactly what Mueller did. He did not indict, even though the obstruction evidence is overwhelming. He just threw the redacted report into the lap of Congress. Well, he threw it, issued it back to the Attorney General Barr, right? And Barr is willing to throw himself on a sword historically here on behalf of Trump, and he redacts the whole thing, sends it to Congress. And Congress says, well, no, give it to us. We want the rest, unredacted. And Barr says, gives him the middle finger. And he says, nope, you're not getting it. Well, now what do the Democrats do? They ride on Mueller. Mueller sided with the Justice Department, right? You got all these redactions. They then allow at 2 weeks, of the after the Mueller report was given to Barr, 2 weeks of delays, and Barr comes before Congress, and he gives a four-page summary, and he says, no collusion. No obstruction, an outright lie, even though he knew in the interim he got a letter from Mueller saying, no, that's not true. There is obstruction, right? You're misleading this whole thing. Barr lies on behalf of Trump. So now they're talking about, oh, we got to impeach this guy. Guess what? He won't even show up for testimony. No one will show up from the Trump administration. And with no one showing up from Trump administration, you think if Mueller gets subpoenaed, he's going to spill his guts? No. Well, the Democrats got outmaneuvered again. And Pelosi says, oh, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to have all these hearings and gather all this information short of impeachment. Well, what kind of hearings are you going to have when Trump says, I'm not allowing any people to come before you, Congress, which is a violation of the Constitution, right? Checks and balances. I'm not going to allow anybody, even if they're subpoenaed, to talk to you. So now they're blocked again. The only outlet they have is impeachment, but they're not going to do it. They're wimps. The Democrats have become, the leadership has become inept, and they're wimps.